Welcome back. This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. There are at least 100 million microbial species that can process sensory information about their environments. But humans are the only organisms on this planet who can do just about anything without thinking. On today's Please Explain, we're talking about our senses, not only how we see, hear, smell, touch, and taste, but also how we maintain balance, feel pain, and how these senses shape our perception of the world. Joining us is Rob DeSale, curator at the American Museum of Natural History and professor at the Richard Gilder Graduate School. He's the author of Our Senses, an Immersive Experience. It's published by Yale University Press, and I am pleased it brings Rob DeSale to today's Please Explain. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, it's fun to be here.
Okay. This isn't just going to be a conversation between me and you. This is Please Explain. And so we are going to invite you, the listener, to join the conversation at 212-433-9692. Do you have a question about the five senses? Give us a call. Again, the number is 212-433-9692. Our senses, An Immersive Experience, was also an interactive exhibition at the American Museum of Natural History that just closed last weekend. Describe that project and what led you to design something like that at the museum?
Actually, the exhibition's open till 2019.
Holy smokes. Yeah. So it didn't close. It's still there.
It's still there and it's wonderful. It's really a lot of fun.
You're going to tell the folks on the website to double check that. But that's great. Keep going.
It's comprised of 11 galleries that approach our various senses that we have, and also approaches how we integrate those senses into what we call perception. And the book was written to complement the exhibition. Mm-hmm. So it was a nice way to get more science into the ideas about senses over what we have in the exhibition.
Now, as I said in the introduction, and as you write in your book, humans are the only organisms on the planet who can think, read, sing, dance, talk, basically do almost anything without thinking. How do we begin to even understand how this is possible?
Well, the one way that we do this is we look at the evolution of the senses, and this is one way that we learn about senses. By looking at the range of senses that other species have and comparing those ranges to the ranges that we have. So, for instance, our color vision is over a very, very narrow sliver of light waves that are out there. There are several orders of magnitude larger light waves into the infrared and beyond, and there are several orders of magnitude smaller wavelengths into the ultraviolet. And we know that there are a lot of animals out there, a lot of organisms out there that can sense into those far away ranges. And this gives us a lot of information about how our visual system works. And the comparative approach here allows us to say something about the extent of our senses.
You say that things like balance and pain should also be considered senses. Why?
Yeah, the classic idea about the number of senses is that there are five, and that comes from Aristotle. Those are called the so-called Aristotelian senses. But balance is also one of these kinds of senses that processes information from the outside of your body. And that's the gravitation is what is kind of driving balance because of the way that your balance organ is built. But there are a bunch of other things that are happening in your body. So, for instance, I'm hungry. I know I'm hungry.
No, I know I'm hungry.
And that's because I didn't have lunch before I came here. I have to go to the bathroom, too. And that's not
in my brain. Are we the same person? Okay, keep going.
And so these are what we call internal senses. And some researchers claim that there are up to 33 senses total. With our five Aristotelian senses in balance, there's another, 27 that are part of our internal biology telling our brain that something's happening, and then our brain translates that into a perception such as, I have to go to the bathroom or I'm really hungry.
So would those two be two of the 27 senses you were mentioning?
Yeah, those would be two of the internal 27 or so, yeah.
What can you give two more?
Blood pressure. My blood pressure is up because I'm very nervous and
would nervousness be a sense, or is it the blood pressure being up?
The blood pressure is the sense is the trigger, and your brain then senses that and forms a perception about it. Also, sensing temperature is another one of these mm-hmm. these things that is in that extra load of 33.
So since I asked the question in terms of balance and pain, I want to focus on balance for a moment, because you write that figure skaters are among the best balancers in human populations. How do they manage to maintain their balance and not get dizzy when spinning?
Yeah, lots of practice and lots of tricks.
So you have to teach yourself.
It's
not
that
you're like superhuman and have a gene.
Yeah, our balance apparatus, called the semicircular canals or our vestibular system, are fairly well set in the way that they're structured, and there's very little variation in that organ in our body. It's in our inner ear, and there's very little variation there. So when a figure skater overcomes dizziness because of spinning, they're using practice and tricks. So one of the ways that you can get over being dizzy after a spin is to do the spin and then to come out of it in a wide arc, and that wide arc gives the skater enough time to gain their balance, or they spin and end up on, you know, with their hand on the ice or something like that, looking mm-hmm. elegant, but at the same time overcoming the dizziness that they've induced in themselves by spinning so fast.
I'm going to have to watch the ice skaters more closely now. Let's go to, we have John in Manhattan who has a call. John.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guest about the idea of sense memory. As a young actor arriving in New York, I studied what's commonly known as the method, and it's based basically on your senses, on the memory within your five senses. So if you want to gather an emotion about something and to get to the truth of that, rather than making it up, you would go to the event and then remember it through smell, through sight, through touch. And so I wanted to know what your guest thinks about that, mm-hmm. If there's any validity by his way of thinking to that, and what he may feel or know about it.
Great. John, okay. Thank you for your call. Rob, what
it's
do you say?
Perfectly logical. The smell that comes in through your nose is a chemical. You process that with the cells in your nose. That sends an action potential to your brain, and your brain in a specific region translates that into a perception. But once that perception is formed, it gets stored in memory, or it gets stored in some emotional context. And so your perceptions then have an emotional and a memory component to them. One of the most famous descriptions of this comes from Marcel Proust, where he, in his voluminous writing, describes the smell of a Madeleine pastry. And the smell of a Madeleine pastry conjures up about, I don't know how many pages of writing that he does, but it conjures up the memories of his childhood. And this is exactly what your caller is talking about.
Oh. Joel in Greenwich, Connecticut has a great question. Joel.
Hey. I've often thought that we have a sense of the passage of time in addition to all our other senses. What do you think?
Thanks, Joel.
Yeah, that would be another one of these internal senses. We have a chemical or a chemical system in our bodies that judge the time of day via circadian rhythm. So we can do that. And that stuff happens outside, not in our brain, but close to it. And then that sense of the circadian rhythm is then transmitted to your brain, and you perceive, say, the time of day or the rhythm of the day. So that is, again, one of those extra 26 or 25 senses that we have to add to our lexicon of senses.
This is a good segue into a call from Alice in Nyack. Alice.
Hi. I find this very fascinating, and I appreciate you taking my call. I wanted to ask about this theory of the 12 senses that were elucidated by the Austrian philosopher Rudolf Steiner at the turn of the 20th century. And he gave a framework for 12 senses, the four lowest senses being developed in early childhood, which are the sense of balance, the sense of movement, the sense of life, which is how am I? Am I cold? Am I hot? Am I hungry? And the sense of touch. And that particularly, so I'll give an example of one of the lower senses and how it attributes to the higher sense of the ego of another human being. So he said that and wrote about that if you have a well-developed sense of touch where your boundary is and where that of the world begins, that you are then able to live into the thoughts and the ego of another human being more readily and more authentically. So I'll just leave it at that and see if there's a comment about that.
Great. Thanks, Alice.
Yeah,
Rob.
Perfectly consistent with... five senses. Some people think there are eight. Some people think there are 12. A lot of the senses that your caller described, I think, would fit into that 33 senses framework, not as neatly as the person who formulated those 12 senses. But certainly, the caller's right. What you perceive with your senses, position in space, smell, touch, things like that, can then be translated into a perception of someone else, of the existence of someone else, or the presence of someone else, or even you can perceive what their personality is from the things that you see and hear from that person, processing that in your memory and processing that with your memory and processing that with your emotions.
And you know, Rob, you write that our senses have arisen as a result of the evolutionary process. Now, is it true that most of the organisms on our planet cannot hear, smell, touch, see, or taste?
Yeah, a lot of the organisms on the planet have very specialized senses. Since most of the organisms on the planet are microbes, more than likely, microbes have far fewer senses than we do. However, the microbes have some senses that we don't have, and one of those is the capacity to sense magnetism. There are certain groups of bacteria that can sense magnetism and orient themselves along a magnetic pole. Probably the primordial sense is a sense of disruption or touch. And this is because cells have a basic structure of having proteins in their membranes. And if you touch a cell, that distorts the membrane and distorts the proteins, and that sends a signal inside the cell. So touch is probably the primordial sense. But we have evolved to use five senses. Other organisms, have evolved to use fewer senses. Some organisms have evolved to, as I said earlier, to expand the range of wavelengths in light or wavelengths in sound to expand their repertoire of the kinds of senses that they get.
So why did humans evolve to have senses or the senses that we have?
Yeah, there's a lot of natural selection involved, and there's also probably some chance involved. And the way that we can think about this is tracing these senses through common ancestors that we have in the animal world. And these senses get honed and get selected because of natural selection. And we end up with the range of senses that we have, again, that very narrow visual range and a really narrow auditory range, and a fairly limited set of olfactory receptors and so on. And we are well adapted to our environment with those senses. It also leaves our brain with some leftover stuff that makes our perception of the world sometimes fairly interesting.
And I can, such as?
Optical illusions. Optical illusions are things that your brain is set to view certain things and to see certain things. And your brain also jumps to conclusions a lot of times. And optical illusions are tricks that take advantage of this capacity of your brain to make quick decisions. The quick decisions are a result of natural selection, because if you didn't make a quick decision when you saw something in our common ancestors, you probably wouldn't make it to the next generation.
Can I ask you, optical illusion and hallucinations, is it a hallucination simply because it's brought on because of the use of of drugs?
There's a lot of hallucinations that occur not as the result of drugs. Hallucinations and optical illusions are different things, but they operate on, again, optical illusions operate on the fact that our brains have evolved to do quick things, and we get tricked by certain things that we see. And hallucinations are a completely different thing, I think.
So so there are two kinds of hallucinations. There's auditory and visual.
Yeah.
So can you talk about those two, and then we'll...
There might even be more than just auditory and visual. Oh. I mean, some people report olfactory hallucinations, and I would any departure from what's really getting in to your sensory system could be considered a hallucination. But the most common are auditory and visual hallucinations.
Like hearing things or seeing things.
Yeah, those are potential hallucinatory events. Yeah.
Why does LSD cause hallucinations then?
LSD is an interesting chemical because it blocks certain things in your brain. Let's just put it that way. It blocks certain processes in your brain, and it also taps into other parts of your brain and jumbles the message that you're getting from the outer world. And it jumbles that message in your brain and gives you a perception that's really way off.
Way off, but unless you're way off, but for artists and musicians, for some reason, they take it and boom, they're already creative people, but it makes them even more creative.
Yeah, there's actually a really neat program that is out there called a Draw program. And what it does is you can program it to say make psychedelic drawings, they use this program to study hallucinations and psychedelic kind of experiences.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Rob DeSale, curator at the American Museum of Natural History and author of Our Senses, an Immersive Experience, for our latest Please Explain. And again, if you have a question about the senses, call us at 212-433-9692. But until then, we'll be right back after a break. We are back on Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and with me for today's Please Explain is Rob DeSale. He is the author of Our Senses, an Immersive Experience, and curator at the American Museum of Natural History. We are taking your calls. If you have questions about our senses, the number is 212-433-9692. Before we go to some of the other calls, there is a question I wanted to ask you early on in the interview when we were talking about balance and pain. And it's kind of quirky, but I'm just wondering, some people argue that plants feel pain. Is that true? And how do we know this?
Well, plants perceive things. There's very famous examples of plants following the sun across the sky, and that is a result of them perceiving things. There's even examples of plants moving back to where the sun is supposed to come up and anticipate the rise of the sun. If plants do feel pain, it's not the same way that animals do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same way that animals that feel pain do. So I don't want to weigh in on that kind of a question, but but it is possible. But again, it would be a completely different process than the one that happens to us when we feel pain.
Do all organisms feel pain? Do all animals feel pain?
That's somewhat controversial. There's some studies have been done on fish. A lot of people think that because fish don't have a certain part of the brain that higher animals do, that they don't feel pain. You need that part of the brain to feel pain. Others would say, oh yeah, it does feel pain. The usual cutoff is around vertebrates. it's hard to say whether, say, jellyfish or things like that, those kinds of animals feel pain. But it's somewhat controversial. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's go to Charles in Varison, New Jersey, who's got a great question. Charles.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. The name of the condition is escaping me. I believe it's synesthesia or something like that. It's where people claim to be able to like smell a color or see a sound, something like that. I was wondering if the guest had any insight into that.
Yeah, the synesthesia is a really interesting example of cross-modal sensing. And what that means is that you have two senses kind of competing with each other. And in the case of smelling, say, colors, what happens is the visual system picks up a color, say yellow, that gets processed in the brain. But at the same time, some of the messages leak out to the olfactory system and induces a smell. So there's all kinds of cross-modal interactions amongst the five senses. So you can have smell and sight. You can have taste and sight. You can have taste and smell. Taste and smell are pretty much connected to each other anyway. But you could have taste and touch. A lot of people the texture of food affects a lot of people in what they hear and what they see. So these cross-modal interactions, when they're really, really strong, they result in people who are synesthetes.
Wasn't it originally thought to be more common in women than in men?
Yeah, the whole idea of inheritance of synesthesia suggest that there was a higher frequency of it in men and women, but that has since been kind of debunked, and researchers are now trying to really pin down the genetics of synesthesia. We do know that it's inherited in families, but the actual genes and the actual genetic processes that are involved in synesthesia are not known yet.
Let's go to James in Tuckahoe, who has an interesting question. James.
Greetings. So my question is, if I close my eyes and I'm in a quiet room, I can re-experience a sight, a picture, a view. I can recreate and re-experience music, but I can't recreate and re-experience a smell, a taste, or say the feeling of a massage. So as vision and audition fundamentally different, or is that an individual difference in me and other people can?
I would think that it's probably a difference in you. There are people who can probably conjure up a memory of smell and can probably conjure up the actual sense of smell or the perception of smell. So my suggestion would be to try a little harder. And maybe you will be able to conjure up the memory of a smell and actually reproduce that actual perception in your brain.
Let's stick with smell and go to Sharon on Long Island. Sharon.
Hi. I have kind of a two-part question. I have a family member who lost his sense of smell as a child due to really bad allergies. And as an adult, he still really, if you ask him, doesn't this smell delicious, he'll say it smells cold. He doesn't really have a sense of smell. He also has a really poor memory of things that happened as a kid. And I'm wondering if those were tied in, and also if it also can affect mood as well.
Well, certainly those, all the things that you mentioned there are neural processes. And loss of smell is actually a fairly common problem. In fact, loss of smell is now being used to diagnose people with Alzheimer's before the onset of Alzheimer's. One of the first things that happens before Alzheimer's takes hold is you tend to lose your sense of smell. It sounds to me that there was some a neurological changes in this person's brain, and it not only affected the sense of smell, but other aspects of neural function.
Thanks very much, Sharon. Let's go to, where is that call? Yeah, there it is. David from Danbury, your question.
So good afternoon. Two questions. One, in terms of evolutionary processes here, is there really any evidence, told there really isn't, and I don't know, but of an eye developing, like an eye just seems to appear in the fossil record or whatever. Second is, how when one loses hearing or sight, they say your hearing improves, gets more keen, but the reverse doesn't work. So the eye doesn't really have that ability to get better because the loss of hearing, does it?
Okay, so the answer to your first question is that researchers know that eyes probably evolved independently about 23 to 25 times in the history of animals. And so what this means is that the eye of, say, an octopus is not the same eye that we have. These 23, 24, 25 incidents of eyes evolving evolve different kinds of eyes. They're all organs that are light receptors, but there are different kinds of light receptors in each of these different kinds of eyes. So evolving an eye is fairly common in the history of animals. Now, your second question, I believe, was about if you lose your sense of smell, your sense of taste gets better, or if you lose your sense of smell, why doesn't your eyesight get better? In some cases, animals have rewired their brains in order to compensate for focusing their sensory systems on a particular kind of sense. So, for instance, a dog is going to have much more of its neural real estate dedicated to smell than, say, a human, and even much more than to a porpoise or a cetacean, which doesn't really smell at all. So, on the other hand, we're a very visual species, and so our visual system takes up a lot more neural real estate than, say, in a blind mole or something like that. In addition, if something like a mole loses its eyesight and tends to start using its whiskers or its claws to sense the world around them, what happens is the brain rewires that region that used to take care of vision to take care of the new sense. So I don't know if I answered your question, but I think I kind of danced around it enough to get it.
Thanks very much for your call. And now let's go to Pat in Forest Hills. We're going to stick with the theme of eyes here. Pat.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Okay, my question is, I have eye problems. My eye muscles are weak. I see double sometimes when I'm reading. I had to learn how to see depth perception. I'm in vision therapy right now. So I don't know whether or not this is a physical, not a defect, but is it, nobody has a perfect body. So how does this affect the senses? Because it's very hard to be focused when I have some paperwork that needs to be done.
Yeah.
Thanks, Pat.
Certainly, loss of vision or altered vision is going to have some impact on your perception of the world around you. I'm not a medical doctor or anything like that, so I wouldn't want to take my comment any further than that. But the aspects of vision that I've talked about so far are color vision, but there's also aspects of acuity and focus that our eyes have. And if you alter any of these things, again, your perception of what you're looking at is going to change, and that's going to have some sort of an impact on how you process that perception.
Thanks for your call, Pat. Now, Todd is on the line from the Upper East Side, and he has a question, and I cannot wait to hear your answer. Todd.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've always had this odd ability, even as a child, to sense or actually smell what I guess is a cold or a virus on people around me. And people make fun of me, or people get very uncomfortable when I say to them, I think you have a cold, or I think you're getting a cold, and they seem perfectly fine. But there's a very distinct kind of metallic smell and I guess I'm, I guess my senses are heightened, or is that something that, am I just a freak of nature?
No, I don't doubt that. I would think, let me give you a good example of smell and kind of a super kind of a smell. There's a woman named Joy Milne whose husband unfortunately died of Parkinson's disorder, and she lived with him for several decades. And when he started to develop Parkinson's, she noticed a change in his odor. I guess married people do that. I'm wondering what my wife is noticing about my change in odor. But she noticed a change in odor, and she told her husband's doctor, who is a Parkinson's specialist, and he said, doctor said, well, let's test this. Let's really test this. And so he gave her a certain number of T-shirts that had been worn by patients with Parkinson's and a certain number of T-shirts that had been worn by patients without Parkinson's. And she nailed all 10 with Parkinson's and got only one wrong for the people without Parkinson's. But wait, the one that she got wrong without Parkinson's developed Parkinson's a year or two later. And so her olfactory system was able to pick up this smell that Parkinson's disorder gives off in individuals with it, and it is a potential really interesting way to think about pre-diagnosing Parkinson's disorder before its onset. So I don't have any, I think that perhaps you would need to test your capacity or your supposed capacity with some scientific rigor, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if you can say smell a virus. Viruses are just molecules, they're just particles, and you may have, say, an olfactory receptor that reacts to the virus. So it's very possible. I don't see any reason why there wouldn't be a possibility for that.
Hey, Todd, can I ask you, when you tell your friends, hey, I think you have a cold, do they end up actually having a cold?
Well, that was what I was going to say. It's not a constant situation. Oh. Oftentimes, they'll call me in 2 days and go, how did you know that? But oftentimes, they don't. So your guest is making me think, I don't know, maybe I'm smelling something else. I don't know what it is I'm smelling. Because I'll walk through a subway, and obviously, at this time of year, I will pass through these clouds. And it's constant. So.
Well, and Todd, it is the subway. We're gonna have to leave it there. I've been speaking with Rob DeSale, curator at the American Museum of Natural History and author of Our Senses, an Immersive Experience. For our latest Please Explain, Rob, thank you very much for being here. This is really interesting.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun.
I've got like 4 more pages of questions for you on this subject, but this is really wonderful. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.